most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you all to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanti Nilayam. This is a series in which we go shloka by shloka or verse by verse through the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, the beautiful conversation that takes place in the middle of a battlefield between Arjuna and Lord Krishna. A very beautiful text, as we have seen before, an essential text in the Sanatana Dharma tradition. Much to learn from, much to understand and much to absorb, and that's why we wish to go through this in a slow pace, absorbing every bit of it as much as we can with prayers to Swami. So this is the fifth episode of that series. We are still in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Probably we'll start with a very brief summary of what we went through the last week. The last week we went through the shlokas from shloka number 12 to 24 of the first chapter. And we saw how the beginning of the war was marked by Bhishma, the eldest of those assembled for the battle, roaring like a lion and then blowing his conches. Then all the Kaurava warriors join him and start blowing their conches and beating their drums. That is followed by Arjuna and Krishna blowing their divine conches. And I had given you a brief summary of why their conches are divine and what is the source of that. That was followed by each of the Pandavas blowing each of their conches, and there are names for each of that. And there is a shloka which mentions each one of that. When all the warriors in the Pandava side start blowing their conch, Duryodhana is rattled by that noise, unlike the Pandavas who were not rattled by the war cry that came from the Kauravas. Duryodhana knew very well that what he was doing was not wrong, and he will have to pay a price. However much he might try to appear confident on the outside, he did have that insecurity feeling within, and that was shown in that. And just when the war was about to begin, the firing of the weapons was about to begin, Arjuna tells Krishna that he wishes to have a better look at who are the people who have assembled there to take part in the war. Especially he says, I want to see who are those who have come to further and fulfill the evil-minded intentions of the Kauravas. So he requests Krishna to take the chariot to the middle of the battlefield, right between the two armies. And Krishna does precisely that. He takes the chariot, he puts it right in the middle, and that's the point where we are about to begin this week's episode. And truly speaking, the first chapter is referred to as the Arjuna Vishada Yoga, and this is the point where Arjuna's Vishada or despondency actually begins. This very shloka with which we're going to start, that is shloka number 25, 26 onwards. The 25 is still, this is probably the first time Krishna speaks in the entire Bhagavad Gita, right? So that is why the shloka number 25 is special. And I hope I'm getting it right. This is the first time Krishna speaks, I believe. And thereafter, Arjuna begins his monologue or internal introspection and reflection. It's a very, very important thing. One might wonder that when Arjuna's reflections begin in the 24th, or 25th or 26th verse, why so much time is spent on all of these other background events? I'm sure there is a purpose for that, and partly we will be able to see that, why this background of what Duryodhana is thinking and what Dhritarashtra is saying and thinking, all of that is part of this Arjuna Vishada Yoga will be seen as we go through. At least a glimpse of that can be had. So without much delay, let's begin this week's verses. We are going to begin with verse number 25. As always, we have Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus, an alumnus of Swami's university. The verses are in his voice. We're very grateful for him for recording it for us and sending it. So we'll listen to the first verse this week. That is verse number 25 of chapter 1. And after that, I'll give you the meaning and we'll talk about that.
Bhishma Drona Pramukhataha Sarveshancha Mahikshitam Uvacha Partha Pashyaitan Samavetan Kuruniti.
In the presence of Bhishma, Drona and all other chieftains of the world, Rishikesha, the Lord said, just behold, Partha, all the Kurus who are assembled here. That's the meaning of the 25th verse, as I said last week, the 24th verse, which we completed with. There, Arjuna requests Krishna to take the chariot right in the middle of the battlefield. And that was also a very beautiful verse where Arjuna is referred to as Gudakesha and Krishna is referred to as Rishikesha. And we spoke of the relevance of that appellation that is given to Krishna. Rishikesha is Rishika Isha, which means the Lord of the senses. And that is so precisely why Krishna has taken the role of a charioteer. And what it is to make Krishna one's charioteer is what we had spoken about last week. So Krishna takes the chariot right to the middle of the battlefield and he tells Arjuna that he positions it in front of Bhishma and Drona and all the other great warriors who have assembled there. And he tells Arjuna that, you know, look at all the Kurus who are here, who are the Kauravas who are here. Technically speaking, the Pandavas are also Kauravas, right? The word Kaurava comes from the meaning that the descendants of King Kuru. So Pandavas are also descendants of Kuru, but eventually they are given the name Pandavas, and Kauravas are referred to as the sons of Dhritarashtra. So here Krishna comes and says, look at all of these people who are assembled here. Here you can see the people from the Kuru clan. That was the verse number 25. We'll go to verse number 26 and probably we'll be able to talk about both of that together.
Tatra pashya sthitan parthah pitrunatha pitamahan acharyan matulan bhratrun putran pautran sakinstatha.
Then Partha saw marshalled among both the armies uncles as also grandfathers, teachers, maternal uncles, brothers and cousins, sons, grandsons, as well as comrades and father-in-law and friends. Part of that meaning actually comes in the next verse where the words father-in-laws and friends, but we'll come to that eventually. But this is where the difference lies between where we started off in the first few chapters. Duryodhana comes and surveys both the armies, right? And he goes to Dronacharya and he gives him a brief summary of the kind of warriors who are assembled to fight, right? And when Duryodhana was surveying the armies on his side, on the other side, he was looking at warriors, he was looking at friends, he had looking at allies who had come to fight by his side. And we also spoke about how he looked at a few people on the other side and he said, and you know, he was kind of feeling that they should have been on my side. And why are they on the other side? Literally in that sense. So he's only looking at the physical might and the acumen when it comes to fighting in a battle, when he looked at the various warriors. And when Arjuna comes and he's looking at all of these people, what does he see? The beauty is Sanjaya is able to see what Arjuna is seeing because he has not yet spoken, right? Arjuna is just surveying the armies and Sanjaya is able to see what is running in Arjuna's mind. So when Arjuna stands there and looks at all of these people on both sides of the army, what does he see? He sees Pitrinatha Pitamahan, fathers and grandfathers, Acharyan, teachers, Matulan, maternal uncles, Bhratran, brothers, Putran, Pautran, sons and grandsons, and Sakhistata, and also friends. Right? And that's what he sees. Krishna says, look at all of these Kauravas who are assembled here. He himself says that I want to see who are those people who are assembled here. But what does he see? He sees all of these people. He sees fathers, uncles, brothers and friends. We'll go to the next shloka and there is an important significance in why it is this difference is important to note. So we'll listen to the next shloka, the 27th shloka, and then we'll probably discuss about that.
Shvashuran suhrudaschaiva senayorubhayorapi tan samikshya sakaunteyah सर्वान् बन्धून् अवस्थितान्।
Father-in-law and benefactors arrayed on both sides, Arjuna then gazed at all those kinsmen before him. He sees Shvashuran, father-in-laws, and Suhridaschaiva, and also well-wishers, right? So when Arjuna asks, who are those warriors who have assembled to fight against us, against whom I must fight, right? That's what he tells Krishna. I want to see who are those people against whom I have to fire my arrows. He says, I want to see who are those evil-minded people who have come to ally with Kauravas, knowing very well that the Kauravas are trying to achieve a selfish end, a evil-minded, crooked end. There are people who have assembled here. So you can sense his contempt at when he's talking about the warriors who have come to fight on the side of Kauravas. That's what he says. Who are these people who have come to further the evil-minded Kaurava's plans? But when he sees, what does he see? At that moment when he sees, everything changes. He is seeing fathers and grandfathers and uncles and brothers and sons and grandsons. He is seeing those who are related to him, right? And in that sense, this is a very, very unique war. And I think that is where, when we are trying to relate to the message of the Bhagavad Gita and the predicament of Arjuna, we have to keep in mind that generally when somebody goes in for a war, at least you talk about a war situation, the people on the other side who are facing you, whom you have to fight against, are people who are enemies, right? It's very easy to fight against enemies. It's very easy to counter those who have motives which are contrary to yours. And in that sense, your priorities are very clear, your actions are very clear. But this is a very unique battle which Arjuna and the Pandavas are supposed to fight, because he sees well-wishers on both sides. It's a very, very rare thing, because Arjuna sees that his own teacher is there, who would love to see Arjuna being the victor in the battle, because that would be a validation of his knowledge that he has taught to his disciple. He sees somebody like Bhishma, who always stood by righteousness. He would eventually like to see righteousness be the victor in this battle, right? Because somebody who has fought for righteousness all through his life would definitely want to see righteousness reign, right? That's what happens even before the Bhagavad Gita begins, where Yudhishthira goes and takes the blessings of all these elders, and all of them wish him Vijayi Bhava, meaning be victorious. So all of these people want to see the victory of Arjuna. So he has well-wishers even on the enemy ranks. He has well-wishers, of course, on his own ranks. So when he looks at all of these people, he sees, you know, I don't see enemies. I don't see people whom I have to kill, but I see people who are related to me. And that's what makes this very different, because it's very easy to differentiate between black and white and right and wrong, right? That is probably most simpler. But life is never like that. All through our life, we are going to be given choices between what is good, what is right, and what appears to be good and what appears to be right. And that is where what is needed in the name of discrimination or in the name of wisdom is much, much more subtler, right? And that is why this particular battle has been taken historically, like, you know, the Bhagavad Gita is supposed to be a knowledge which is eternal. It is supposed to give us an ability to raise our consciousness to in this journey of our life, right? But why has it been put in a context like the war in the story of the Mahabharata? It's because of this. It's a classic case of a person finding it difficult to see what is right and wrong in a situation where there is no black and white, but there are actually grays. That is why it's very important. What Arjuna sees is not enemies arrayed in front of him, but he sees well-wishers arrayed in front of him. He sees brothers and uncles and sons and grandsons arrayed in front of him. We'll go to the next verse. In fact, the next couple of verses, the verses 28 and 29, we'll take it up together, because there is the continuity is better that way. So we'll listen to verses 28 and 29, and then I'll give you the meaning of that.
Krupaya paraya vishto विषीदन्नितमब्रवीत्। अर्जुन उवाच दृष्ट्वेमं स्वजनं कृष्ण युयुत्सुं समुपस्थितं सीदन्ति मम गात्राणि मुखञ्च परिशुष्यति वेपथुश्च शरीरे मे रोमहर्षश्च जायते।
The son of Kunti, Arjuna, seeing all those kinsmen thus standing arrayed, spoke this, sorrowfully filled with deep compassion. Arjuna said, "My dear Krishna, seeing my friends and relatives present before me in such a fighting spirit, I feel the limbs of my body quivering and my mouth drying up. My whole body is trembling and my hair is standing on end." So this is Arjuna beginning to express what is going on in his mind. Till now he was only looking. It was Sanjaya who was giving us a hint of what was running in Arjuna's mind. For once, for the first time, Arjuna himself speaks out. And what does Sanjaya describe Arjuna's plight? He says, Kripaya Paraya Avishto, overwhelmed by compassion. Right? He's so overwhelmed by compassion that he is beginning to break down. And it is not ordinary compassion. It's not just kripaya. He says paraya kripaya, which means very deep compassion. This is a sign that Arjuna is genuinely feeling pained by seeing them, right? It is not, sometimes we would try to run away from a competition out of fear, but we will be masking that fear with the idea that idea of compassion, idea of friendliness or whatever it is. But that is not the case here. Arjuna is really deeply pained by what he is going to undertake in the next few minutes or in the next few days thereafter. Because he is deeply moved by true compassion. That's why, you know, Vyasa uses the word Kripaya Paraya Avishto. He is moved by deep compassion. And Arjuna is genuinely feeling pained by seeing all of these people, right? So he is able to see, Sanjaya is able to see Arjuna's compassion and that compassion being genuine. And then he goes on to say that Vishidan Idam Abravit. And moved by that sorrow, moved by that deep compassion that is leading to this deep sorrow, he spoke thus. He says, Drishtva imam swajanam Krishna. Arjuna says what he is seeing. He is not seeing an army which is in front of him. He is not seeing an army which is behind him. He is saying drishtva imam swajanam Krishna. He is saying I am seeing my people. Right? When I see all these people who belong to me, they have all come here to fight. And when I see them, Arjuna says, when I see these people come here to fight, my own people come here to fight, what does he say? He says, Sidanti mama gatrani. My limbs are becoming weak. Mukhamcha parisushyati. My mouth is drying up. Vepathuscha sharire me. My entire body is trembling. Roma harshascha jayate. My hair is standing on end. It's a very famous shloka, this and the lines which is in the next shloka, where Arjuna describes his physical plight, that seeing this, he's so moved and he's so upset by what he's seeing. He's moved by deep compassion, and that deep compassion is leading him to a very sorrowful state. And as he's standing there, he says, these are the different things which are happening within me. And we'll go to the next shloka, because in a way it is also a continuation of what Arjuna is describing his physical plight to be. So we'll listen to that and we'll carry forward from there.
Gandivam sransate hastat tvakchaiva paridahyate nacha shaknom yavasthatum bhramativa cha me manaha.
The bow Gandiva slips from my hand, and also my skin burns all over. I am unable even to stand, and my mind is reeling, as it were. So as continuation of that, in the earlier shloka, he says that my limbs are becoming weak, my mouth is drying up, my entire body is trembling, and my hair is standing on end, and he says my Gandiva is slipping from my hand, and also my skin is burning all over, I am not even able to stand. My mind is reeling as I am looking at this scene in front of me. The great Gandiva is slipping from his hand. You know, this is supposed to be a very, very figurative and a very powerful imagery which is being given, because the Gandiva is supposed to be a great bow, as I had mentioned last week about Arjuna's chariot and Arjuna's conch. The Gandiva is also a gift from the god of the fire. It's supposed to be a very special bow, and I think elsewhere there are descriptions of how not many people will be even able to lift it. It requires enormous amount of physical strength even to be able to wield a bow like the Gandiva, and that itself shows what a great warrior he is. And such, and that Gandiva of such repute is slipping away from his hand, right? And he's feeling all of these tremblings, and the mouth is drying up, and all of that. It's a very interesting anecdote which Professor Venkatraman would narrate many times when he speaks about the Gita, where the great freedom fighter Rajagopalachari, or whom we fondly refer to as Rajaji, when he was taking part in the Satyagraha movement in the 1940s, where Mahatma Gandhi had told all the leaders to quote arrest and, you know, subject themselves to arrest by the British government, where Rajaji was also one of those leaders, and he was taken to the court for some of the sedition related letters that he had written. And there was this Muslim gentleman who was the chief presidency magistrate. His name was Abbas Ali. And he was very fond of Rajaji and his writings and his, as a personality, because he was a very, very great scholar. Rajagopalachari himself has written a beautiful book on the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, when he was imprisoned later, he took classes on the Bhagavad Gita for all the inmates of the prison. He was a very, very great scholar. He had written a book on the Mahabharata, on the Ramayana. So this magistrate, Abbas Ali, was an admirer of Rajaji, and when he had to pass a judgment on this person, he knew very well that, you know, this was part of the Satyagraha movement. But he also knew that being a magistrate representing the British government, he had no other option but to look at the evidence in front of him and charge Rajaji with and send him off to this prison. So at that moment, actually, this magistrate, who was also a very well-read man, quotes these lines from the Bhagavad Gita, where he says, "My hands are trembling, my mouths are drying up, and my hair is standing on end." And he says that that is my plight today when I have to charge Rajaji and send him off to the prison. And Rajaji himself is very moved by this quoting that he's listening to, and he says, "I'm very sorry that I've put you through this uncomfortable situation." But then the judge himself says that, "But as instructed by Krishna to Arjuna, one has to do one's duty, and that's what I'm going to do." And he says, "But I hope the great Rajaji will forgive me." So that is, I always remember that, because Venkatraman sir would always quote that incident. So that is what Arjuna is saying here. He says, "This is what is going on in my mind." There's another anecdote which Swami would often narrate when speaking about Arjuna and Arjuna's focus and Arjuna's abilities as an archer, where when Arjuna is under the tutelage of Dronacharya, at one point Drona calls all of these disciples, all the Pandavas and the Kauravas, and there is a bird on a tree, either a bird, a live bird, or I think he's made a model of a bird and he's put it on the tree, and the lesson for the day is supposed to be that the archer is supposed to hit an arrow right through the eye of the bird, right? That is the lesson of the day. So he calls all of the students one by one and he asks them, "What do you see?" So each one says that, "I can see the tree, and on the tree I can see a bird." And somebody says that, "No, I can see there's a nest next to the bird." Or someone says that, "You know, I see this whole thing, the whole forest, and this is one tree," and all of these people. But Arjuna comes there, and when Arjuna is asked, "What do you see?" Arjuna says, "All that I see is only the eye of the bird," right? That is the kind of focus that Arjuna is capable of. The moment Arjuna says that, Dronacharya realizes that he is going to be the greatest archer, because that is what it calls to be the greatest archer, that kind of focus. So that focus is actually becoming weak right now. Because Arjuna says, "I want to see who are the warriors I am able to fight, I am supposed to fight against." why does a warrior want to see who are the people who are assembled in front of him? And in fact, he would also would have wanted to see the battle formation which is in front of him, right? That's what we would do. You know, even in a game, even probably when a batsman takes guard in a cricket match, he looks around to see the field placement, right? That's how he's going to go about his game, based on what is the field placement, and there's a way by which you can even assess what is the ball going to be based on the field placement. So that's what a warrior is supposed to do. He's supposed to go and look at the battle array in front of him, the formation in front of him, and see who are the great warriors. What are their strengths and what are their weaknesses? How is he going to deal with all of them? Right? So that is the focus with which Arjuna goes to see. But what does he see? He sees fathers, grandfathers, brothers, friends, and teachers. And when he sees that, his focus actually starts wavering. There's a very beautiful short story that I had come across a long time ago, where there is this archer who is supposed to be very renowned for his immense abilities, right? So he goes from kingdom to kingdom displaying his abilities in archery. And the kings are very, very pleased by the display that he is able to put forth. And so they reward him for his talent, right? So he goes to this one particular kingdom and, he displays his talent. There are different kinds of ways by which he does that. He shoots, a target which is so far away, and he splits a small piece of stick which is kept. And, he's got a sequence of events that he does. So he does all of that. The king is very, very impressed by what he sees. Then finally, the king says, I would like to give you a competition. Would you like to participate in that? So the archer says, very well. So the king takes an apple from the tree which is next to him, and he places it on the head of one of the ministers, and he looks at the archer and says, will you be able to shoot this down? So the archer says, very well, I can do that. There's no problem at all. That's probably one of the simplest competitions that can be given to me. So he says, I can shoot that apple down. There's no problem. But the king says, there is a caveat to that, and there is a condition to that. He tells him, one, if you're able to shoot down that apple, I will give you 1,000 gold coins. So the archer is very happy. But if you miss it, if you're not able to shoot the apple, or if you hit the minister by mistake, then I will chop off your head, and I will chop off the heads of all your family members, right? That's what the king says. The moment the king says this, the archer says, now I cannot hit the target. And he says, now I cannot participate in this contest that you're giving me. I will not be able to hit. The king is very surprised, because he also knows that what he has given is a very simple competition for this archer. Probably he just wanted to reward this archer, but he just gave it a little twist by saying that here is the reward and here is the punishment. But he was surprised that the archer, who was saying that this is a very easy contest for me, suddenly is saying that no, I cannot participate in this because it's become difficult. So the king asks the archer, why is it becoming difficult now? The same contest, why has it become difficult for you now? And then the archer gives a very beautiful explanation. He says, oh king, I am an archer. You put a target in front of me, I can hit it. You wake me up from my sleep, I can hit it, right? That is my ability, that is my talent. But if you put two targets in front of me, that is when I will miss my aim. He says, if you put two targets in front of me, I'll miss my aim. And then the king asks, what is the meaning of that? Where are two targets here? The two targets are, one, I should hit the apple, and the other target is save myself and my family, right? And when this target of saving myself and my family comes, my focus starts getting deterred, right? So that is exactly what is happening to Arjuna. Because Arjuna is looking now at two targets. And what are those two targets? One is winning and one is losing. And as we go through the first chapter, we will see that now it's beginning to occur to him that winning and losing does not seem to be as black and white as he thought. All this while, when he was preparing for the battle, he thought that winning is going to give him something which losing is not going to give him. But now he is beginning to see that there are actually two targets, that winning also means the same thing, losing also means something very similar. And that is why winning, when it loses its charm, Arjuna's focus starts wavering, and that is the cause for his problem, right? So similarly, Arjuna is also losing focus. Why? What does he see? Yes, that's what we saw, that what is he seeing in front of him. But we'll go to the next verse. We will see what is wrong in this. What is wrong about why Arjuna is losing his focus?
Nimittani cha pashyami viparitani keshava na cha shreyo nu pashyami hatva svajana mahave.
And I see adverse omens, O Keshava. I do not see any good in killing my kinsmen in battle. So what does Arjuna see that he loses focus? He sees Swajana, his own people, right? He says, Nacha Shreyo Anupashyami Hatva Swajanam Ahave. He says, I do not see any good coming out of me killing my own people. Swajanam, my people, Arjuna says. And why is this important? This is the third or fourth time this word is being uttered by Arjuna. He says, Swajanam. In the first verse of the Bhagavad Gita, what did we see? We saw Dhritarashtra asking, Mamaka Pandavas Chaiva, what are my people and the Pandavas doing? And we specifically pointed out that is where Dhritarashtra's blindness truly lies, because he is blinded by Mamakaram, where he says, these are my people and these are not my people. Right? Here Arjuna is also displaying the same Mamakaram. He says, Swajanam, how will I battle the people who belong to me? How will I kill those who belong to me? And he says, I do not see any good coming out of me killing those people who belong to me. But the only difference with Arjuna and Dhritarashtra, Arjuna is not as blinded as the Dhritarashtra in that real sense, because here Arjuna is not saying Mamaka Pandava or Mamaka Dhritarashtra in that sense. He is standing right in the middle of the battlefield, Senayor Ubhayor Madhye, right in the middle of both the armies, and then he is saying Swajanam. So he is seeing that both peoples on both sides of the army are my people, and I do not see any good coming out of the death of my own people, right? So Arjuna is displaying a certain amount of broad-mindedness which was not seen in Dhritarashtra, and that is a virtue, right? Which is itself a virtue in that sense. He is also showing the same amount of attachment. There's no doubt about that. There are same signs of attachment in that, and there is no doubt about that, but he is far more broad-minded than Dhritarashtra, and we will see that that is one of the important qualities of Arjuna, because of which he is able to solicit the greatest wisdom from Krishna himself. And then he goes on to say, Nimittani cha pashyami viparitani keshava. He says, I see adverse omens also. He tells Krishna that not only do I see that I'm going to kill all these people and I'm going to, it's not the right thing to do. He says, I'm seeing all bad omens, right? This sometimes happens to even us, you know, when we don't want to do a task and we will look around, we will look for different omens and say, oh, see, this is happening. Maybe Swami does not want me to do this. And then, you know, this is occurring. Maybe this is not the right thing to do. Oftentimes we do that, right? We make up our mind, or we have a certain fear, or we have a certain worry, and we tend to color all the things that we see around as bad omens or omens supporting what we want to do. And that's similarly what is happening to Arjuna here. Till now, what he was seeing around was a perfect battle condition, right? Something a warrior would strive for, right? A person who is very, very good at what he is doing will want competition of this kind. This is probably the greatest moment of the life of the warrior that Arjuna is. But the moment his focus starts shaking, he sees bad omens. The same omens which he thought was a wonderful setting for a great battle now begins to appear like bad omens which are trying to deter him from what he is trying to do. And that's why he says, Nimittani cha pashyami viparitani keshava. I'm seeing all adverse omens as I stand here. And in this manner, Arjuna's introspection begins. And one of the most beautiful things whenever I go through the first chapter, it occurs to me is, this is probably how anybody who wants to do a little bit of counseling to a person who is low has to first of all do. You can see how patiently Krishna actually listens to Arjuna, right? Probably, I mean, the first time when Arjuna says, how can I fire arrows against Swajanam, Krishna could have stopped him right there and said, what a fool you are, right? But Krishna does not do that. Krishna allows Arjuna to go into his reverie, go into this introspection, pour out whatever is troubling him, allows him to speak out whatever he wants to speak out, and then only starts counseling him. So probably anyone who wants to give a piece of advice to another person, who wants to help another person through counseling and wise words, the first thing is, at least for one chapter, let him pour out whatever is in his mind or whatever is in her mind. So the listening is, the aspect of listening is the first and foremost important thing when it comes to counseling. And that's what we can see here. Krishna knows exactly, you know, where Arjuna is going wrong, what is wrong with Arjuna's arguments. As we can see in the next chapter, in the second chapter, he's going to break down everything into smithereens. But he's allowing Arjuna to pour out whatever is there in his mind so that he can be all tackled at once. So that is probably one important tip anybody who wishes to counsel another person who is in distress has to do. So this is how Arjuna starts introspecting, right? Now, my way of, my suggestion to all of you is, because this was a suggestion I had to myself, now let us not go through the verses that are going to come after this with the idea that Arjuna was wrong or Arjuna got it all wrong, right? Let us not go through that. Let us go through the verses thinking that Arjuna is actually noble, right? Because these are all noble thoughts. Arjuna can very well go into the battle and single-handedly probably defeat the Kaurava forces, right? That's how talented he is. In spite of that talent, he is asking himself, what is the use of this battle, right? As I said in the introductory episode, one of the qualities which gave Arjuna the badhyata or the deservedness to receive the wisdom from Lord Krishna is this purva tapa, his ability to look at what are the consequences of his actions going to be, right? So these are all noble thoughts that Arjuna is expressing. It is noble thoughts that are born out of, as we said, paraya kripaya, deep compassion and broad-mindedness, because he's standing there right in the middle of the battlefield. He's looking at his own brothers and he's looking at those who are assembled to kill him and his brothers and saying that all of them belong to me. What will happen if all of them die? What good is going to come when all of them die, right? So let us not go through these verses in the first chapter thinking that, oh, Arjuna was so foolish, or Arjuna was so stupid, or Arjuna was so deluded. Yes, he was all of this. We will come to that when Krishna starts speaking. But now when we go through these verses, let us remember that these are all thoughts which are born out of the nobility of Arjuna or the goodness, deep goodness of Arjuna. If vishada or despondency alone can make one worthy of receiving the highest knowledge, because Gita gives the highest knowledge, it is a text of Brahma Vidya, right? That is why Bhagavad Gita is also referred to as Gita Upanishad, because it gives you the highest Vedanta. So if pure despondency or pure worry or pure fear and vishada alone can give you that kind of highest knowledge from the Lord himself, probably Dhritarashtra should have been more qualified, right? Because that's the life history of Dhritarashtra. He is despondent from the time he is born, because he is born blind and he's always despondent that he is actually not as capable as his brother and he is not eligible to be a king. So he was despondent all the time, and then when it came to his sons, he was always worried, will his sons rule the kingdom? Will the Pandavas outshine him? What if this war will take place? And he knows that this is what is going to happen. At some point, his sons are going to lose because they are on the path of adharma. So he fears for them, he worries for them. He is, in that sense, much, much more despondent than anybody else. So if despondency or vishada alone can give you Brahma Vidya, then probably Dhritarashtra is much ahead in the race. But it is not simply Vishada Yoga, it is Arjuna Vishada Yoga. And another meaning for the word Arjuna, or the meaning of the name Arjuna, is white, right? So when we say Arjuna Vishada Yoga, it is when Vishada is coupled with purity, that white represents purity. When a pure, noble soul starts introspecting out of despondency, out of deep depression and deep compassion, that is when it becomes yoga. It is not any despondency, any depression, or any fear, or any worry, right? Because that is why I said that the verses which relate to the dialogues of Duryodhana were also important. Because Duryodhana is also showing nervousness. Duryodhana is also showing a lack of confidence. But he is not, it is not Duryodhana Vishada Yoga. He is not entitled for this ultimate yoga. Because his despondency is born out of his insecurity that he is on the path of adharma. But that is not the case, right? So when a person of goodness and purity is given to despondency, he or she is entitled to yoga. That is why it is Arjuna Vishada Yoga. There's a very beautiful verse which Khalil Gibran writes about pain, about suffering itself. I always find that a very beautiful description of the importance of suffering in one's life. I'll read out those few lines for you before we move forward. He says, "The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven? And is not the lute that soothes your spirit the very wood that was hollowed with knives?" So beautifully, Khalil Gibran says that for you to be able to receive the ultimate, you should be prepared with suffering. You should be prepared by sorrow. And he says, the lute that soothes your spirit, the very wood that was hollowed with knives, the cup that holds the wine was burned in the potter's oven. So similarly, this Vishada, or this despondency that Arjuna is going through, that will ultimately lead to Brahma Vidya, or the knowledge of the self. So it is not to be looked at with indignity or rebuke. As Swami puts it very, very beautifully in Gita Vaini, in the first chapter or the second chapter, Swami puts this. Swami explains why the first chapter is referred to as Vishada Yoga. I'll read out those few words. I quote, "You refer to it as despondency, but that despondency was very beneficial. It was no ordinary want of courage, for it tested Arjuna's sincerity and steadfastness. It induced him to take unquestioning refuge in the Lord. That is why it is dignified by the name Yoga. The Gita begins with the Yoga of despondency, Vishada Yoga, and ends with the Yoga of renunciation or detachment, Sannyasa Yoga. Despondency is the foundation, renunciation the superstructure. Despondency is the seed, renunciation is the fruit." End of quote. As Swami says, it is not despondency, it is this despondency that led him to true sannyasa that Krishna is going to explain eventually, right? So that is why when we go through these verses, let us remember that these are actually the signs of Arjuna's nobility. But goodness and nobility will also lead to fear, right? It is not that somebody who is always being dharmic and always being good will not have any kind of suffering, will not have any kind of despondency. But when a good noble person is despondent, when a good noble person is depressed and is worried, that will lead to higher wisdom. Not in the case of Duryodhana, when there is despondency and when there is insecurity inside, he tries to bury it down. He tries to cover it up with a fake confidence that he's showing outside. But that is not the case. And that is the reason why this comparison is given of how Dhritarashtra is looking at the army, how Duryodhana is looking at the army, and now we are coming to how Arjuna is looking at the army. That nobility with which he is seeing it is so very obvious in these words. So the next few verses we'll go through with the idea of how noble Arjuna is, not with the idea how deluded Arjuna is. The genuine goodness of his character will shine in the next few verses. So we'll go to the next verse, which is actually the 32nd verse. We'll listen to it and I'll give you the meaning after that.
न कांक्षे विजयं कृष्ण न च राज्यं सुखानि च किं नो राज्येन गोविन्द किं भोगैर्जीवितेन वा।
I desire not, O Krishna, nor kingdom nor pleasures. Of what avail is dominion to us, O Krishna, or pleasures or even life? So that's the meaning of the 32nd verse. A very, very beautiful, it's very important to understand the thinking of Arjuna and why his thinking is noble, right? He says, Nakankshe Vijayam Krishna, O Krishna, I do not desire victory. Nacha Rajyam Sukhani Cha, not even kingdom or the pleasures that come with the kingdom. Kimno Rajena Govinda, O Govinda, of what avail is the kingdom to us? Kim Bogaihi, of what avail is enjoyments? Jivitenava, for that matter, what avail is life itself? Right? He says, Arjuna is so low that he says, I do not desire victory, I do not desire the kingdom that will be obtained by that victory, nor the pleasures that will be got by winning that kingdom. And eventually he says, what use is all this to us? For that matter, what use is living itself? Why is this great warrior feeling this way suddenly, right? Because as I said, this is going to be the pinnacle of achievements of his lifetime, and suddenly he's saying that I don't find living itself beneficial, right? He's so low, he's so despondent. You know, we all like victories and pleasures. When do victories and pleasures lose their charm? That is the question we need to answer. That is the question we need to dwell into, and that will tell us why Arjuna is thinking the way he is and why Arjuna's thinking is noble. We'll go to the next two verses, that is 33 and 34, and probably we'll discuss more about what Arjuna says in 33 and 34 and try to understand where his thinking comes from.
Yeshamarthe kankshitanno राज्यं भोगा सुखानि च त इमेव स्थिता युद्धे प्राणान् त्यक्त्वा धनानि च आचार्याः पितरः पुत्राः तथैव च पितामहाः मातुलाः श्वशुराः पौत्राः
Those for whose sake we desire kingdom, enjoyments and pleasures stand here in battle, having renounced life and wealth. Teachers, fathers, sons and also grandfathers, maternal uncles, father-in-law, grandsons, brother-in-law and other relatives. That's the meaning of the verses 33 and 34. He says, Yesham arthe, for whose sake kankshitam no rajyam, we desire to win this kingdom, bhogaha sukhani cha, and also material enjoyments and happiness. He says, yes, we want to be victorious, yes, we want the kingdom, yes, we want to have the pleasures that come with the kingdom, but for whose sake do we desire all of these things? Yesham arthe, for whose sake we desire all of these things? They have all come here to the battlefield, and how have they come? Tyaktva pranam dhananicha, having sacrificed their life and wealth, they have come here. Or having come here, they are ready to give up everything, and this is a battle which is going to be really fatal in that sense, right? Arjuna knows that this is going to be a very, very gruesome and fatal battle. Most people who have come, I've come knowing well, very well, that this could probably be their last battle. There are such fierce warriors on both sides, and they would not come if they were not prepared to accept the eventuality of losing everything, including their life and wealth, right? That is the situation here. And again, Arjuna says, who are those people that he sees? Acharyah, Pitrah, teachers and fathers, Putraha, Pitamaha, sons and grandfathers, Matulaha, Shvashuraha, maternal uncles and father-in-laws, Pautraha, Shalaha, grandsons and brother-in-laws, and Sambandhinaha, other relatives, right? So these are the verses that show that Arjuna's approach and nobility, as I said, and the very fact that he's standing in the middle of the battlefield, and he's not telling this only about the people in front of him, but even the people behind him, his own army and the army in front of him. Now, why is this important? Why the way Arjuna is thinking? Probably we'll discuss this a little further, and we'll end with that. You know, when you talk about pleasure, a very beautiful thing that Arjuna is saying here is, yes, we want pleasure, and to get that pleasure, we need the kingdom, and to get that kingdom, we need victory. But the very pleasure that we seek, there are, you know, you can look at pleasure as being of three types. One form of pleasure is the pleasure that comes to the body, right? That's probably the most basic form of pleasure, the pleasure that comes out of satisfying the senses. And Swami would often say that if we were to seek only these pleasures, we will be leading an animal life, right? Because an animal is driven by the pleasures of the body. Its dharma itself is ingrained in the way it seeks pleasure for the body, right? That's how animal is programmed. So having become a human being, if we are only trying to satisfy the pleasures of the body, then it's probably the lowest form of life that a human being can live, an animal life in a human body. So that's the lowest form of pleasure. The second form of pleasure is, I'm not looking at pleasure only for myself. I'm looking at pleasure for even those who I refer to as mine, right? That is the second level of pleasure where, I mean, we see that within the family, a father who earns for his children, a mother who is ready to sacrifice her food for the children. How are they able to give up the pleasure that comes to their own body by giving pleasure to the others? Because that is the second level of happiness, where you find a purpose in giving up your own pleasure for the person who's right in front of you, who is attached to you by this term mine or mamakaram, right? That is the second level of pleasure, where you're not purely living like an animal, but even that is to an extent an animal existence, because as Swami would often say, you know, without an education, a bird and an animal is able to feed itself and its family. So that is slightly better than a very selfish and basic animal life, but still that is a little lower, right? And within this pleasure of what I talk of as, not only am I happy when I am satisfied, I'm happy only when my family is satisfied, then there is your idea of mine starts growing. Right? Instead of just saying that my family should be fulfilled or my family should be fed, some people start becoming broad-minded and saying that, you know, my whole village has to be fed, or they begin by thinking that my whole community has to be fed, or my own country has to be fed. Or some people become so broad-minded that let's go out and help the whole world. And we also see some people who go beyond even the idea of the human race. They say that all other species have to benefit, and let's go and help, you know, the species that are becoming extinct, be it the sharks, the dolphins, or the turtles. These are all ways by which we expand, and we come to the conclusion that my pleasure comes by satisfying my own needs, and to an extent satisfying the needs of the people who belong to me, and I am constantly expanding this idea of who are those who belong to me. And we come to a very, very broad vision of my pleasure and the pleasure of my people by saying, Vasudeva Kutumbakam, right? The whole world belongs to me, and thinking about the pleasure of everybody. And that is why Arjuna's thoughts are noble. When somebody like Dhritarashtra is not able to think of people beyond his own family, right? The Pandavas are not actually beyond his family also. They are his own brother's children. But he looks at even the Pandavas as alien to his family, right? That's how narrow-minded Dhritarashtra is. But here is Arjuna. His brothers actually are only 500, but he looks at all his cousins who are 100. He looks at all of these other people who have come to support him, who are all in some way related to him, either, you know, through blood or as friends and well-wishers. So he's able to look at all of these people and include them in this idea of Swajanam, which he says, my people. For Dhritarashtra, my people only meant his family and his children. But Arjuna has expanded it But the reason why this is still not ultimate is because the pleasure does not end with merely satisfying the sensory needs of your own people and yourself and the other people. True pleasure comes from, as Swami would say, you know, the ultimate pleasure comes only with Brahma Vidya or the understanding of the Supreme, right? That is where Arjuna is stopping. Arjuna is becoming very, very noble, very broad-minded, but he is stopping at that threshold of that achievement. And that is why Krishna is urging him to go forward, right? And that is why the Bhagavad Gita is not merely a Dharma Shastra. A Dharma Shastra will tell you what is the right way of living, how you can be a good father, how you can be a good teacher, how you can be a good son, right? There are other texts like that, which only teach you about how to be a good king and all of that. That those are meant to make you better at what you are. But a text which is supposed to teach you Brahma Vidya will take you till the final lap. It takes you beyond this idea of goodness and takes you to the idea of godliness, right? That is where, and only a person who has come to the level of goodness is capable of going beyond that to the level of godliness. That is why it is Arjuna Vishada Yoga. Arjuna has reached that threshold of goodness and nobility and he is having despondency. He deserves to be taken beyond that, right? Now, the other thing which is important in whatever he is saying, Arjuna is saying, is very important relevance is, see, when we look at pleasure, it's very easy to say that this is what gives me pleasure, this is going to give me pain, this is victory and this is defeat. But sometimes, what is a victory may not really be a victory. What is a pleasure may not really be a pleasure. And it requires one to be having a subtle knowledge to be able to differentiate that. Something very simple like that is, you know, let's say there's a patient who is inflicted with jaundice. If you're having jaundice, you're not supposed to eat food which is deep fried or which is made with substantial amounts of oil. But if you eat a deep fried item, whether you have jaundice or you don't have jaundice, you probably are going to relish it. You're going to have pleasure being given to you through your senses, right? But for a patient who's having jaundice, hidden behind that pleasure of eating a deep fried item is the pain of what he's going to suffer because of that act. So what is a pleasure is not actually a pleasure. So similarly in life, you know, especially when we are within the family, I think when we had many, many questions in the answering booth about how to deal with issues in the family. See, when you punish a person who is very close to you, you're not going to punish him with detachment. You're not going to punish her or him with detachment. You are going to be hurt in the process too, right? So that is why when you're dealing with situations within the family, it's a completely different thing. It's not easy to say black and white that this is what you should do and this is how you strictly you should be. The moment you say mind, the way you treat yourself is going to be reflected in the way you're going to treat the person whom you call mine, right? That is why it calls for a little more subtle understanding and subtle wisdom when we are trying to deal with situations like this. Swami would often say this when you talk about knowledge or jnana, there are three types of knowledge, right? Which are actually jnana itself with a few prefixes added to them. Swami would say vijnana, sugnana and prajnana. Well, these are Sanskrit words which have different meanings based on their context of usage, right? Vijnana also means science, but vijnana also is used in vijnana maya kosha, which means the ultimate wisdom. So I'm not going into that. I'm only talking about when we look at these three words together, vijnana, sugnana and prajnana. When we talk about vijnana, the prefix V is added to mean that when you separate one from the other, when you cut and make two, right? That's when we use the word V. That's why it's used in Viveka, Vibhaga, Vibhakti and all of that, when you're separating two. So Vijnana is when there is clearly what is right and wrong in front of you and you make that differentiation, when you make that distinction. Sugnana is the jnana which comes out of goodness. It is a sukshma jnana, right? It's not, I'm not giving you the exact split up of the word sugnana. Sugnana, the definition or the exact meaning of that is only good knowledge, right? That knowledge which comes out of inbuilt goodness. And Arjuna is in this stage where he's talking about Sugnana, where he's able to, with that idea of goodness, he gets this Sukshma Buddhi of looking at this victory and saying that, my God, I'm suddenly realizing that this victory is not actually going to be a victory. I might win the kingdom, but it's of no use because I'll end up killing all of those people for whom I wanted to win the kingdom. I'm going to end up with enormous pleasure, but I'm going to end up with it without the people whom I thought I will enjoy this pleasure with. So suddenly he's able to see beyond black and white. Suddenly he's able to see beyond victory and loss and pain and pleasure. And that is why he is in the level of Sugnana, where his goodness is able to make him see with his Sukshma Buddhi or his subtle intelligence. But unfortunately, that is where Arjuna stops. And what Krishna is going to do is going to take him from Sugnana to Prajnana. As Swami would say, Prajnana is the ultimate wisdom, where you realize that it is God alone who operates through you. It is God alone who operates through everyone. And that is why in the second chapter, when we come to eventually, I think in a couple of weeks, we'll come to that, Krishna gives him the highest wisdom. He hits him with the highest jnana first before he starts explaining other things. Because the attempt here is to take Arjuna from the stage of Sugnana to the state of Prajnana, or the ultimate wisdom. And that is where we will see the difference between goodness and true goodness, or divine goodness, if we could put it that way. So we'll conclude with that. We've stopped at the verse number 34. We'll continue with that next week. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. If you have, if anything that I said was not clear enough, you're always welcome to write to me, and I'll be happy to explain that, or probably explain that further in the next episode. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'll join you all again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of the Gita series. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his Vahini Satsang team. Happy listening.